Accession number 31693, reel 16.
Mr. Robson, reel 16. So you said that you finished basically at 1 o'clock during the summer season. You'd have your breakfast. Was food in Hong Kong basically the same as you were getting throughout the British Army life?
Yes, exactly the same. Obviously, with being married, living outside, the only time you were allowed to eat in the barracks is if you're out on exercise, and if you wanted a meal, you had to pay for it. And all you used to do was go up to what they call the PRI, and you would pay so much to have a meal in barracks. Apart from when you were on duty, for instance, if you were on guard duty and you lived out, you were allowed to eat and not pay for the meal in barracks. So yes, it was exactly the same food as anywhere else. There was no difference.
Did you have a normal mid-morning break in your routine?
Yes, 10 o'clock you would have what they call nappy break, and again, because nappy break used to stretch from 10 to 11, but you would only get a half an hour break, so it would change each week to see which companies would go to the nappy first, so that everybody didn't descend on the nappy at the same time. Otherwise, you would never get served. And where we worked, down at the... if we went down working on the vehicles, which was at the other side of the camp, it was too far away to go to the nappy. So what we used to do, or what they used to do, they would open up a little shack where our vehicles were, and we would get our break there, and they would bring down pies and they'd have tea and chocolate and everything else. So the guy would come down, but he used to come down for an hour, so we used to sneak a little bit extra, you see, but we would always be aware that we could be at any time the Kulisan Brynolf, not so much San Brewis, but Kulisan Brynolf would catch us skiving. So you had to be careful on that. But we had a system going. Because we had a field telephone down where our vehicles were, and of course where down to the signal stores. So the signal storeman, if Constable Brynolf would say to him, "I'm going down to visit the vehicle compound," he would give us a quick bell and he would let us know that he was on his way down. But yeah, sometimes we used to get caught. But hey, if some soldiers didn't skive, you know, he always tried to beat the system somewhere.
So after 1 o'clock, was it that your sporting afternoon or the leisure afternoon, or what happened to you then?
Rest afternoon.
Rest.
Troops could go out. Troops could. Married soldiers could leave the barracks. If I remember rightly, single soldiers couldn't during the working week. It was too hot to play football in the summer anyway. But we used to play cricket, and but I don't think not they weren't allowed out of barracks during the summer. I'm sure. And if a soldier was going to visit a friend who was in married quarters, they used to have to get a special pass, even though you lived in quarters. You still had to get permission. And I suppose in a way it was with being responsible because that's how affairs first started. So a married female wouldn't be allowed to invite a male friend, for instance, unless the husband was there. I can see the point.
So, following this leisure period, did you start up work again at some point later in the day after the...
No,
that was your day finished.
That was your day finished. It was just too hot. And then 5 o'clock, I think 5 o'clock, at past five, that was when troops were allowed to go out.
What about the changeover when the weather itself changed?
No. When the weather changed, during the winter... first winter there, you didn't feel any change in the weather, really, because it was still warm. But it was back to normal duties, but in barracks by 7:30 if you lived out. Prayed 7:45, 8 o'clock, and you were back to normal hours. You would work
right through the day,
right through lunch. Normal time. Again, the guys who lived at Champs-Chapeau, they ate in they would either bring the lunch in with them or eat in the naffy. You know, the naffy used to have meals on for those living out, even for those who lived in. If the guy walked in, didn't fancy that meal, whatever was on that day, then we'd go to the naffy and have a meal. A lot of that happened because we had our naffy. We had two clubs. I'm sure we had two clubs, one in the main barracks and the other one which was down by the swimming pool. They built another one right next to the swimming pool, that was it. And there was a gate there, and rather than coming right through the barracks, there was a gate which was open until a certain time, which was manned by, I'm not quite sure whether it was by the guard or whether it was manned, I think it was manned by the Hong Kong unit that we had with us, the Chinese unit, and they were pretty strict as well, and because they didn't like getting told off, and they used to book everybody in who were going to the swimming pool, and yeah, and the naffy shop, because there was a proper naffy shop opened as well. That was the second year that we were there. So I've just remembered that. So yes, it was back to normal, just normal daytime duties. And again, you would carry on. And again, you, because of the nature of the signals, you would keep up to date on certain stuff. And also, we'd have our courses running at that time, i.e. the signals courses. And the signals courses for the platoons, because they needed their own signalers, because we couldn't, as a signal platoon, supply every platoon with signalers.
We only went to company level.
The regimental signals officer, the supplies, and it was during that time when I became an NCO, and this was prior to Captain Townsend leaving. I was given the task of being the CO's radio operator. Manpack radio operator. So wherever the CO went, me with my radio on the back, but this is only on the exercises, not in the barracks, and I would be with the CO, who at that time was Lieutenant Colonel Peter Fleming, and the company and my company commander at that time was also called Fleming, and he was next KYI man.
What was the colonel like?
Old fashioned, very old fashioned. The RSM we had at the time, his name will come to me, but he was ex-wartime soldier, Chadwick, RSM Chadwick. Tremendous, tremendous RSM. So at the time we had RSM Taylor, RSM Tommy Chadwick took over from him, MM, got the military medal during the war. And he was tremendous. Wonderful guy, lovely guy. Absolutely smashing guy.
You said the CO was old fashioned, but by that you mean strict in the old routine, old way? Not particularly not close to his men, is that?
Not, no, that's right. Not particularly close. Even me, as his radio operator, I mean, later, commanding officers, and I mean, my first commanding officer was a man called Lieutenant Colonel D'Arcy Irvine. He was tremendous. He would stop everybody and speak to him. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with Peter Fleming, but he didn't endear himself to the troops as much. I don't know why. I think it was a bit old-fashioned. I mean, when I was as his Lance Corporal, if we want to talk about a particular exercise, we went on an exercise called Exercise Bugle March. And I was his radio operator. And I remember one night, I mean, we were on our feet for most of the time. We covered, in the exercise, over 10 days, something like 80 miles over the hills in Hong Kong. It was tough. And we'd be doing, if we were doing a night move, you took your boots off and you put your plimsolls on to keep, you know, to keep the noise to a minimum. Because at that time, I'm trying to think when we were issued with the boots DMS, which was the rubber sole boots. But anyway, I remember one particular night, and in those days we weren't issued with proper sleeping bags. You took a blanket off your bed when you went out in the field, and you wrapped it up in your ground cape, your ground sheet, and went to sleep like that. There was no pillars, no air pillars. You weren't allowed to, in those days, you weren't allowed to make yourself comfortable by getting an air pillow. You just had to wrap it, part of your clean stuff that you had in your haversack, and use that as a pillow. But I remember one night, we'd stopped. I don't know whether it was the first night or whatever it was, but I remember him saying to me, because we hadn't had the new equipment, the new radios, where you could turn what you call the mush, from the ionosphere, you could turn in the newer radios, you could turn it down and you would lose the mush. In those days we still had the mush sounding over the radio. And you were aware on your ear, and you had this mush coming through the earpiece all the time, and you would have to listen to it with your left ear whatever orders were going on. And I remember kind of Fleming saying to me, "Turn that damn radio off, it's disturbing me sleep." And I remember saying to him, "Okay, sir, I'll have to get permission from control, from headquarters. I'm the CO, I tell you what to do." So with that, I just turned the radio off. I thought, well, he said he's the CO, I'll turn it off, I'll face the consequences later. So if there's anything came through of any importance, not my fault. And that's exactly what I did. So the next morning, I thought, yeah, that's all right. Because as a CO's operator, you didn't have somebody else to help you. You kept watching on the radio all yourself, there was nobody you could turn around and say, well, there you go, you relieved me. You didn't get that. Sometimes his batman would carry a battery for you, but very rare, because he was carrying the CEO's kit. So the next morning, I don't know what time it was, about 5 o'clock in the morning, switch the radio on, ask for permission to join the net, promptly got a rollicking, where had I been all night, messages for the CEO, and I just said, if there's any problems, speak to the CEO. And it wasn't until the exercise finished that we were doing a debrief, because we always used to do our own signals debrief, and we sat down. I remember Captain Townsend said to me, what happened, Colin Robson? Why did you turn the radio off? I said, you take it up with the CEO. He ordered me to turn it off, and when I told him I was going to get permission, he told me that he was the CEO, so as far as he was concerned, he was giving me permission. So he knew what had happened. And then eventually there was various other things that happened. And I got to the stage where, well, the next big exercise, I remember our ORBAT, order of battle for the signal platoon, my name came up, CEO's operating again. Because that time we tried to change it. Although he did work a lot with the companies, you stayed with the companies. Sometimes you'd get a change, you see. Because you don't always see eye to eye with the person you work. And rather than falling out and not doing the job properly, they used to change people. So I saw my name up with the CEO again. And I remember saying to Captain Townsend, can I have a change? He says, no, he says, you're the only one who can control the CEO. I thought, after that last exercise, I don't think I controlled him very well. So but after that, it was we saw eye to eye.
How many exercises did you have of this nature, and what was the aim of the exercises?
The aim, I don't think I was. I might have been told, but I can't remember. We just did a. It was a big exercise, and there was another battalion who would be the enemy, and so on the Chinese. I think it was mainly the Chinese.
Yes, they were up on.
To be perfectly honest, there's no way we could stop the Chinese. No way on earth. But that was the exercise. And then when the other battalions had exercises, they had umpires. And you would go out as with an umpire, and you've just done that exercise, and you would go out and do the same exercise as an umpire, doing exactly the same thing. I remember spending coming off exercise Bugle March and going, having a week off, and going out and doing the exercise with an umpire, with one of the officers. And I must admit, at that time I was very, very fit, but after the second exercise, I'd overdone it. I ended up with yellow jaundice, and I spent a month in hospital. And by that time, Captain Townsend had left, and Captain Churchill had taken over. And I remember the RSM, who was Tom Chadwick, going up to him and saying, I'm excused drill. This was it was during the summer, Wednesday afternoon, sports day for everybody else. No, it wasn't a sports day. It was in the summer, and everybody was off. But the RSM had said all NCOs would do extra training, NCO training. And I remember saying, I said, I'm excused drill. Give him my chit. He looked at me, he says, no, you're not excused drill. he ordered me to go sick to this place in Nathan Road, and I remember going in there, and the doctor looked at me and said, have you brought your pyjamas with you? And I remember saying to him, no, I live in quarters. He says, right, he says, whereabouts do you live? I said, Chungking Mansions. He says, right, go down, get your pyjamas, because you're going in hospital. And I was in hospital for a month while I recovered. And I must admit, because I was fit, I recovered quite quickly, and I was back on duty within 6 weeks.
So these exercises were up near the frontier, the border.
They were, yeah. They're out in there, yeah.
What was the terrain like up there?
Part jungle. Up in the Shamshipur is the biggest, or the highest hill in Hong Kong. It was quite bare, although there were areas of jungle. And I can't remember a lot of, because we did a little bit, but I can't remember much about the jungle side of it, to be perfectly honest.
And you'd be out on how long would they last, these exercises?
Exercise Bugle March, I think that lasted about 10 days. I think we're out 10 days.
And living under the stars, you might say?
Living under the stars. No tents. I can't remember even. I think we used to get resupplied. I can't remember actually eating. Because sometimes, I mean, the companies weren't so bad. They had their own chefs with them. But being the CO, with the CO, sometimes we just lived on 24-hour ration packs. And it was the old 24-hour ration packs where you would have 3 or 4 days' worth of supplies, and you would be carrying these, and they were tins, not the hydrated ones they get now. The old 24-hour ration packs were quite heavy.
What was in them?
Tins of, let me think, like meat, pie, rice, biscuits, Mars bar, a bit of chocolate, because you would only have a breakfast, and a tin of beans, egg and beans, and sometimes sausages, and then there would be tea bags. And I must admit, toilet-wise, you had to go out and dig a hole in the ground. Now people would even, say no, but you did literally have to do that. But the beauty about 24-hour ration packs, I don't know what it did, but it used to block it up. It really did. So you weren't.
It may have been deliberate.
It could well have been. But these 24-hour ration packs. I mean, there were the stuff inside. They're saying now you should have a minimum of 1,000 calories, 1,500 calories per day to eat. But these were high protein meals in the 24-hour ration packs. So, I mean, they did the job. You were never hungry after one. And you used to have your breakfast, and then you would have something. Or the other thing was curry. I used to hate it if I got curry, because at that time, curry and rice I never ate. It was only much later when I went to Borneo that I started eating curry.
Did you warm this food up yourself?
You would do it on. You would have your own personal cooker in there, what they call hexamine blocks, and you would heat up the meal. You would do it yourself. There was sufficient in there. And then each individual person, I mean, the CEO, he would get his mate for him, because the batman would do it. But sometimes, being the radio operator, they'll still be doing the radio operating, and I'll be halfway cooking a meal, and they'll say, right, let's go and visit one of the companies. And I would look at my meal, and fortunately, I would scrounge some when I got to a company, you know, especially if the cooks had been up and they'd been doing their own field cooking, I'd be able to get something to eat there. But it was, he never used to think about these things, you know.
Would you be off the beaten track? I mean, were you moving on foot?
On foot.
Land Rovers couldn't.
And then, it would be on foot. And then, we'd meet up with the vehicles after doing maybe an overnight march, and then go to another area, and then we'd be on our feet again, and then there'd be stuff like that. I mean, we were on our feet quite a lot. Bugle march, I would say, that's one of the toughest exercises I've ever done.
In what way?
Out in the field all the time and on your feet. We covered some miles. I can remember on one stage I was walking along a track, and the radio equipment I was carrying, fortunately, we had the new carriers where they had the packs on the carriers themselves, so the radio fitted inside. And then you just put your equipment, what they call the kidney pouches, on that went in there, like your mess tins and various other bits and bobs. You could actually fit in the new packs. And I remember one stage walking down a track and just blacking out. And then that actually woke us up, believe it or not. And I'd be carrying an SLR. Or an SMG. I think at that time I was carrying an SLR, and an SLR was quite heavy as well.
So what kind of weight would you be carrying?
I would be carrying, I mean, the radio equipment I was carrying myself was 45 pounds. Then I'd have my own personal kit on top of that. So the 45, I would be having 60 pounds on my back.
There was quite a weight.
And at one stage, on another exercise, I actually carried a spare radio to go with the radio I had, and the batteries to go with the radio. They were quite heavy as well, and I would carry one spare one with my equipment. And if I had any more, I used to have to say to the CEO's batman, you'll have to carry a radio battery. And they were quite heavy.
Good.